Great to have you along for Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. In the 2013 movie thriller Captain Phillips, Tom Hanks plays an American shipping captain taken hostage by Somali pirates.
1 minute, I will kill all your friends.
If you want to shoot somebody, shoot me!
Relax. Everything gonna be okay. Look at me.
Sure.
Look at me.
Sure.
I'm the captain now.
That was from the trailer for Captain Phillips. The movie is based on a true story and involves a dramatic escape and rescue. But there were thousands of other merchant sailors taken hostage around this same time, and many languished, some for years, with little mention in the press. Colin Freeman brings some of their stories to light in his book, Between the Devil and the Deep Blue Sea, The Mission to Rescue the Hostages the World Forgot. Welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you.
Now, you are uniquely qualified to tell this story. This is just incredible to me, because you yourself were captured by pirates?
I was, yes, back in 2008, just at the start of the Somali piracy crisis, really. I was working for a British newspaper at the time, the Sunday Telegraph, as one of their foreign correspondents. And we went to Somalia, to the Somali coastline, to do a bit of reporting, really, on the pirate situation and what the local people thought of it. And we got rather closer to the story than we wanted, really. We were kidnapped by a group of pirates and held for 6 weeks in a cave.
And do you feel like, I mean, I don't want to get too much into your own story, but were you abused? Did you feel like you were treated similar to some of these sailors who had been captured?
Generally speaking, we were not mistreated. It wasn't very comfortable living in a cave for 6 weeks. We were threatened a few times. They did threaten once or twice to torture us. They demanded money for our release, and they threatened to torture us if the money didn't come through. That was pretty frightening. When you're in that situation, being held by armed men, they don't actually have to lay a finger on you, really. All they have to do is insinuate that they might, and that puts the fear of God in you, I can tell you. We also had one or two other nasty experiences. There was a gunfight in the cave with a rival clan at one point. Mm. We're not sure why. Maybe they were coming to try and steal us or something. So it was a pretty scary experience. But in the wider scheme of things, compared to what some people went through when they were kidnapped by Somali pirates, we were very, very much at the lighter end of things, almost kidnap light, you could say.
These hostages that you decided to write about, how long were they in captivity?
Some of the there was three ships of three hijacked ships that I wrote about, all hijacked at different dates. But they spent one ship was hostage for nearly 5 years, another for four and a half, and one for more than 3.5 years, which really made my ordeal something like a walk in the park, really.
Mm. Why do you think these captives received little media attention, you know, unlike Captain Phillips in this, you know, thriller movie?
Well, to give you an example, one of the ships I wrote about was a ship called the Albedo, and it was a ship registered in Malaysia, owned by a firm that was based in Iran, and crewed by a staff variously from Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, Iran, and Sri Lanka. So it had a multinational crew on board. And it was hijacked in late 2010. And what would normally happen during these hijackings is that you wouldn't get a Captain Phillips-style situation with the US Navy running to the rescue. Normally, what would happen is that the ship's owners would have no choice but to negotiate a ransom with the pirates. That wasn't what the ship owners wanted to do. But when the pirates had guns held to the heads of the sailors, there really wasn't an awful lot of other options. In Captain Phillips, you see a group of sharpshooters, US Navy snipers killing one of the pirates at the very end. But normally that is not an option that navies go for. because the risk is far too high. And also in these situations, a lot of the countries involved just didn't have the kind of navies that, say, for example, America or Britain have, that would have that kind of capacity. So really, there was, in the majority of cases, there was no option but to pay the negotiate a ransom. The pirates would usually start by asking for maybe 10 million and settle for maybe half a million or a million. And then what the ship owners would do would be to reclaim that money from their insurers. Most of them took out a special kidnap and ransom insurance, whereby the ransom money would be reimbursed. Mm-hmm. But in the case of the Albedo, the ship owners did not, as far as we know, do that, which meant that when the ship was hijacked and the pirates demanded a large ransom, the owner really had no money with which to pay, because he had no insurance, he had no way of paying the ransom. And it was the same on the other two ships that I wrote about as well. Mm-hmm. That was the one thing that all these ships had in common that had been stuck for years, was that the owners had no means of paying the ransom. And now you might expect that after some time the pirates would get tired and bored, you know, and you know, just
well,
give
5 years,
up.
Yeah, 5 years.
But that doesn't happen. These pirates are from Somalia. It's a very, very poor part of the world. Once they've done a hijacking, you know, they just don't give up easily, and they take the view that time is going to be on their side. The other problem for these hostages was that the pirates simply didn't believe the owners when they said they had no money. And in order to try and put extra pressure on the owners, they tortured the crews. In one case on the Albedo, for example, there were sailors being flogged, beaten senseless for days, weeks, months on end. One sailor was executed in cold blood. Mm. Still no ransom was forthcoming. So it was an absolute scandal. But it's an interesting question as to why nobody really paid any attention, or why it got no coverage in the press. One of the things is that when hostage situations take place, whether they're at sea or, you know, on land, there's usually a request for a kind of blackout of publicity, because that often has the effect of making the kidnappers agitated. But in this case, I think it was simply the fact that the sailors were all from poor countries, and, you know, they were being held very far away from, you know, their home countries. And, you know, it was a case of out of sight, out of mind. And their families, they were mainly poor people, didn't have the means to make their voices heard.
Before we get into these specific stories anymore, I want to just kind of understand this heyday of Somali piracy. How did piracy become such a threat to big ships? I mean, you talk about Somalia being a poor country. How did they have the capacity to attack ships way out in the ocean? And some of these are hundreds and hundreds of miles off the Somali coast because they're trying to stay away from them, but unsuccessfully.
Yeah, well, the piracy crisis really started in about 2005 or so, and it started off with local fishermen just attacking marauding foreign vessels that were poaching their fish. And the idea was that it was a bit of vigilante justice. The local fishermen would get on board the foreign vessels and rob them, and the idea was that it would deter them from coming and stealing any more of their fish. That's the kind of the folk version of events, if you like. I think that may have happened a little bit at the beginning, but it quickly morphed into a much more organized system of proper piracy, whereby the pirates would not just attack fishing vessels, but pretty much any passing vessel, whether it's a cargo ship, a tanker, or anything else. And as time went on, they also started sailing much further out into the Indian Ocean, hundreds of miles, often using what were known as motherships, which were other vessels that had already been hijacked, which they would use as kind of floating command and control stations. Mm. And they would go out in them for 3 or 4 weeks at a time. And soon you had ships being hijacked, you know, anything up to about 1,200 miles from the coast of Somalia, pretty much the whole of the western side of the Indian Ocean, which is a vast area.
And you already talked about the fact that some, you know, most nations don't have the navies to police this area or maybe any area in the ocean like the U.S. or the British navies. Would just kind of give us a sense of how vast this area where the piracy was occurring is.
Well, it's, I mean, it's roughly about the size, you know, the size of the western half of the USA. It's an enormous area. Mm-hmm. And as the piracy problem grew, most of the world's naval powers, from America and Britain to France, Russia, China, India, sent naval ships to the area to try and stop the problem. And they tried to corral the passing shipping into sort of narrow sea corridors so that they could protect them as best they could. But even then, you know, in an area that vast, it was like having, you know, one or two highway patrol cars policing the whole of Route 66 or something. Mm-hmm. They were just never going to be in the right place at the right time. And the pirates could appear on the horizon, attacking a vessel. And usually the vessel would have about 15 minutes between seeing the pirates coming and having the pirates try to board. And if there wasn't a naval ship that could arrive on the scene within that time zone, then they were stuck. So you can see how difficult it would have been.
And so I think maybe just give us the example of the Albedo, how pirates actually get on board, because you would think with the advantage of some height over, you know, you're looking down on the pirates, and I guess they had hoses they could spray the pirates with. How come pirates are often so successful in getting onto these massive ships?
Well, what the pirates would do is they'd approach in skiffs, which are basically kind of wooden fishing boats, narrow wooden fishing boats, rather like the go-fasts that you hear cocaine smugglers in Latin America sometimes using. And they would shoot up to the vessel. If it was a big tanker, maybe with a 25-foot high deck clearance, then it was often quite difficult to get onto. But they would take with them grappling ladders, which are special ladders with hooks on the top, and they would sail up or speed up alongside the ship, try and hook one of these grappling ladders over the rails of the deck, and then just swarm up it. Quite often the attacks were unsuccessful. The ship would get away, or the pirates would try and get the grappling ladder on the side of the ship and then fall off and end up being killed or injured. But if they got a relatively slow moving ship, maybe only doing 14 or 15 knots, which is about 16 or 17 miles an hour, then they were usually able or quite often able to clamber aboard. The ships like the Albedo, for example, would often have hoses or electric fences around them that they could switch on to deter the pirates. But on the Albedo, for example, the electric fence, which they'd installed, was not switched on. In the panic, whoever's job it was to switch the electric fence on, they forgot to do so. And as a result, the pirates were able to get on board the vessel relatively quickly.
And these vessels didn't have guards, I guess. And I'm curious if it seems like this age of piracy has kind of dwindled. Are ships these days now carrying armed guards?
Yes. At the beginning of this piracy crisis, insurers were asked, well, what about having armed guards on board? And they were reluctant to allow that because they were worried, firstly, about the legal risks of what might happen if somebody shot a pirate by mistake or shot an innocent fisherman. And they were also concerned about having weapons on board a ship that was going in, calling in at numerous different international harbours, and some ship owner getting in trouble for having a ship in the port without their correct weapons licenses. So for most of the first few years of the piracy crisis, from about 2008 to 2012, nobody had armed guards on board. Then really bluntly, things just got to the point where there were so many ships getting taken hostage that the insurers had a change of heart. they started putting armed guards on board, and that pretty much nipped the piracy in the bud. Overnight, the piracy pretty much stopped. The reason being that if you're on a large tanker and you've got a couple of security guards with a machine gun nest, you effectively turn the ship into a kind of floating citadel. It's nice and stable. The pirates, meanwhile, are bouncing around on the ocean waves. It doesn't take much for the security guards to fire a few warning shots, and most of the pirates at that point got the message and headed off. Mm. But by that time, they'd already hijacked an awful lot of vessels.
Right. And I want to get back to your stories. The Prantelet fleet, this is an interesting story because it shows what a tricky spot the hostages were put in, because the pirates who took them captive couldn't get the ransom. And so they conscripted the sailors, the hostages. Will you tell us about that?
Yes, this was the Prantelet 12 was a fishing vessel from Thailand. It was hijacked in 2010. And I think a few months into the hijacking, when it became clear that the owner had no money with which to pay the ransom, or certainly wasn't paying what the pirates wanted, the pirates said to the crew, right, we are going to make you work as a mothership. And you are going to come, you're going to sail the ship around and help us look for other ships to hijack. And I think they said to the sailors at the time, look, if you can help us find another ship that we can hijack, we'll let you go. So off they went, rather reluctantly, because they didn't really want to, you know, exchange their freedom for somebody else's. But they really had no choice, because guns were pointed at their heads. And they did actually go and get near to a Bangladeshi ship, which the pirates then hijacked. And at that point, I think they hoped that they would also be set free, but the pirates broke their word. I think this probably happened quite a lot, actually, because most of the time the pirates would not have known how to use the motherships themselves. The motherships were quite frequently, because they were bigger vessels, were quite frequently crewed by the hijacked staff on board.
Was there a happy ending for the Prantelet hostages? I mean... because they could end up being called pirates themselves.
Well, they carried out these activities, you know, as a mothership with great reluctance, but they really had no choice. And then they ended up being stuck for nearly 4 years as hostages. And during that time, they weren't tortured particularly, but they were not treated well. They were put on starvation diets a lot of the time, only getting, you know, a cup of rice a day and inadequate drinking water, water that was often brackish. And as a result, six of them contracted an illness called beriberi, which is a vitamin deficiency illness. It makes your limbs swell up horribly. And they died while in captivity. And the rest survived. And eventually they were rescued out by a man called John Steed, who was a former British diplomat who was working as a counter-piracy advisor for the United Nations at the time. And he rescued both the crew of the Prantelet and the Albedo, the ship I was talking about earlier, and another hijacked trawler, simply by having realized that if he didn't do anything, then nobody else was going to. And so he went and he raised the money to rescue these, pay the ransoms for these ships himself, pretty much his own private rescue mission, if you like.
We're speaking with Colin Freeman. He's the author of Between the Devil and the Deep Blue Sea, The Mission to Rescue the Hostages the World Forgot. Coming up on Constant Wonder, we're going to hear more about the bravery and ingenuity of John Steed. Stay with us. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. We're speaking with Colin Freeman. He's the author of Between the Devil and the Deep Blue Sea, The Mission to Rescue the Hostages the World Forgot. So you just introduced us to John Steed, who's working with the UN in a capacity of helping with hostages of pirates. I just Now, does the UN pay ransoms, though? I mean, this seems kind of tricky because you said he kind of raised this money on his own, but he's working for the UN. I don't understand the relationship there.
You're right. It's a tricky one. John was originally a British military attaché, a former British Army officer who was working for the British Embassy in Kenya, the country next door to Somalia. He then moved to work as a counter-piracy officer for the United Nations. That's where he learned about the plight of these three hijacked ships and realized that nobody was really coming to their rescue. He got in touch with the pirates to see if he could help in any capacity. They said, really, the only way out of this is for money. And at that point, he decided to see if he could raise the money to rescue these hostages himself. But it did mean having to distance himself from the UN because, as you say, the UN cannot be seen to be involved in ransom payments in any way.
Well, where did he get the money then?
That was quite difficult. You might expect that there'd be some billionaire somewhere who would just quietly write a check for a few hundred thousand dollars or a couple of million dollars and just say, right, get this over and done with. And I think that's what John initially thought would happen, but it turned out to be a lot harder than that. Most philanthropists, most charities, most good causes are quite reluctant to get involved in paying ransoms to criminals. It's illegal to do in some countries, for example, in the US. It also doesn't look good. It's not good for their PR. And also from a moral point of view, most people do not like to be seen to be giving money to criminals. And they could also argue, look, it's the responsibility of the ship owners or the ship owners' governments to get involved here, not private individuals. So it was quite hard for him to raise the money, especially for the first ship, the Albedo. He rescued them once at a time. And he had a bit of a whip round. He managed to get some money out of the shipping industry in London and got about $200,000. But that alone was not enough for what the pirates wanted. They wanted several times more than that.
And I guess he himself got conned by a potential donor.
He did, yes. Well, he was getting, pretty desperate to find donors. And he had done one or two interviews in the media talking about his mission and, just not directly appealing, but dropping subtle hints to sort of say, yeah, I'm a man, who needs money. And one of these interviews was actually with my newspaper, The Daily Telegraph. And as a result of that interview, a German sea captain or a man claiming to be a German sea captain came forward and told him that he could offer him $600,000 from a German seafarers union. So John thought at that point, great, my problems are over. And he went ahead and struck a deal with the pirates to pay them something like $600,000 or $800,000 for the freedom of the Albedo sailors. Unfortunately, when he went to ask this sea captain for the money, it was never forthcoming. And the sea captain eventually gave a series of excuses and then just disappeared completely. And John and one or two of the other people who were helping him believe that that particular individual was a con man of sorts and that he was he'd managed to get involved in some email correspondence with John, and they think that he was using that email correspondence to go around other people pretending to be an agent of John's, essentially, and hoping that they would donate money to the cause, which he was then going to pocket. The particular sea captain, he vanished. If he ever was a sea captain, he vanished off the scene. So we'll never really know what it was he was planning to do. But the bottom line was the money did not come through. John was then in the awful situation of having struck a deal with the pirates and then suddenly finding himself without the money to do so. And he was very worried that given these pirates had already killed one hostage and tortured a lot of the others when negotiations hadn't gone their way, when the owner was failing to pay them any money, he was very worried that they would kill further hostages and this would be on him, basically.
So the hostages kind of get they kind of get creative because now they only have the 200,000 and they kind of flip one of the pirates. Will you tell us how that came about?
Yes. So after the con man failed to deliver the money, John was left with about $200,000 to play with. He realized that he was going to get no more. The pirates were saying, "We want several times that." Eventually, though, a deal was struck with one of the pirate commanders, a man called Ali Jabin, whereby they would pay him the entire $200,000 just for him and one of his accomplices. And in exchange, he would arrange for the hostages to escape. By that time, the hostages were actually on land. They weren't being held at the sea anymore. And so that is what this man, Ali Jabin, did. He arranged for the rest of the hostages to escape in return for being paid the entire $200,000 himself. But it was a big risk.
I'm just curious, how were they able to get around the other pirates? What was so special about Jabin that they could relay this plan to him?
Well, the idea for this, for paying Jabin the $200,000 himself, was not John Steed's idea. It was actually an idea that one of the hostages came up with, who had made a point of gradually befriending Jabin and learned how to speak Somali during all those years in captivity. And you know, I think just during all that time together, they gradually struck up a bit of a relationship. And Jabin used to confide in him, saying, "Look, I'm fed up with this as well. I've been stuck here for 3 years, and I'm getting pressure from the other pirates to strike a deal." And at this point, the hostage just sensed that, you know, he could perhaps appeal to Jabin's own sense of greed, and he said, "Well, look, why don't you arrange a deal with John Steed to let us escape, and you take the entire $200,000 for yourself?" It was a gamble because it meant trusting a man who was a pirate and also getting into a deal with him where he would then rip off his fellow pirates. It's not the sort of deal that most hostage negotiators would ever go anywhere near. Mm-hmm. But they thought, well, we really don't have any other choice. There is, you know, these guys have been stuck for years. Nothing else has worked. And so that's what they planned to do one night.
So they're in Somalia being held, I guess. And what is the escape plan?
The plan, it sounds pretty harebrained. They were being held in a shack, a kind of shack turned into a makeshift prison on the edge of a village in a remote part of Somalia. On the night in question, the plan was for one of the hostages to drug the guards' food with sleeping pills that this guy Ali Jabin had secretly given them. The idea was that the guards, who I think were beginning to get a bit complacent by then anyway, the guards would often spend half the night sleeping anyway. These pills would simply ensure that they were all out cold all night. So they slipped the pills into the guards' food. The guards spent the whole night asleep and the hostages all escaped out through a window and disappeared off into the Somali bush. Unfortunately, on the night in question, for some reason, nobody had told John Steed that this was happening. So the first he knew about it was that he got a phone call in the middle of the night saying, "We are out, we are free, but we are stuck in the middle of the Somali bush. And we are lost. Can you help us?" Luckily, John had already kind of prepared a contingency plan. He rang one of his Somali contacts who organized an armed escort to head into the bush to look to a search party, really looking through the Somali bush to find these escaped hostages. It was very dangerous territory, full of other pirate gangs and all manner of other rogues. Luckily, they managed to find them managed to take them back to freedom. But there was every chance that it could have ended in disaster. If they'd been caught trying to escape, they would have probably been almost certainly been killed.
And yet he doesn't rush them home. Steed keeps the hostages together really for some time. Can you explain why he did that?
Yes, I can. This happened to me as well when I was released. It's a common practice when someone comes out of hostage captivity that you give them what's known as decompression time before they go home to see relatives or loved ones. The idea is just a little bit of time on your own or with your fellow hostages while you just get readjust to normality a bit, usually sort of 2 or 3 days or something. And that's what he did with John Steed did with these hostages. He took them to Nairobi for about a week before they returned home to their families. In that particular case as well, because the hostages had been kept in captivity for 3 or 4 years, they had come to regard each other really as their main family. And he wanted them to be able to say their goodbyes to each other and just really acclimatize to being back in the world again before going back to see their wives and their families and so on, because it is a big adjustment. These guys had spent years just, having to ask for permission to go to the bathroom and things like that. And then suddenly to have them, going back to normal society again, where there's all sorts of decisions you have to make in life, that's a really big jump. So you have to ease them in as gently as possible. There was also just the prospect that they were going to miss each other a lot. They'd been through hell together and they'd helped each other and, seen each other suffer and in some cases seen people die. So it wasn't something that you could just do lightly.
So how are the hostages doing today?
Most of them seem to be in pretty good shape. I'm in touch with one or two of them. One of them has gone back to sea again, now working with a slightly more reputable maritime line, and he's cruising the world again. He doesn't seem to be bothered about the fact that last time he went to sea he was hijacked. It seems to hold no lasting trauma for him. Occasionally he tells me he informs his fellow sailors, younger sailors, of the dangers of what can happen if you sail into pirate waters. Some of the others have decided never to go back to sea again. And then sadly, there are quite a few who died during captivity and their families have had to move on. And one or two have been helped by seafarers' charities to set up bakeries and their own businesses and so on. But and then I'm afraid to say there are a few others who have been pretty badly broken by the whole thing. One man who was very badly beaten up while in captivity has suffered lasting mental health problems. One or two others have drifted into problems with alcohol and so on and depression. That is hardly surprising, I think.
And John Steed, is he satisfied with the work he did?
Yes, it nearly broke him at times early on. The stress of all this may or may not have been a contributing factor in a heart attack that he suffered that nearly killed him. And he was advised not to carry on with things, but he did. And with hindsight, he says, it was the challenge of getting these people out and the idea that he was doing something important that kept him motivated. And he said that the sense of reward when you finally got people freed was just unbelievable, of giving them back their life again, which sounds like a bit of an exaggeration. But I think actually it's not far off the truth. He really was doing that.
Colin Freeman is the author of Between the Devil and the Deep Blue Sea, The Mission to Rescue the Hostages the World Forgot. Thank you for sharing their story with us today.
You're welcome.
This is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor.
You can always find something from The Princess Bride that fits. The snuffly grandson in that movie tells his grandpa, "Murdered by pirates is good." Well, actually, murdered by pirates is not good. Escaping from them is, if you can't avoid them altogether. For some reason, pirates have an enduring charm for people who really ought to know better. Next on the show, we're going to separate fact from fiction and try to figure out the roots of all that charm. Constant Wonder will be right back. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Earlier this hour, we heard the tale of a daring escape from Somali pirates. You may recall a few years back, large ships were being routinely seized and the crews held for ransom. That now seems like one problem the world may have gotten pretty well contained. But I don't recall at any point in the Somali piracy saga that children and romantics of any age imagine that a pirate's life off the coast of Somalia was bold or fun or adventurous. Were pirates ever actually glamorous? Well, it turns out that the mythology of piracy was largely mythical. I hope you're not surprised. A lot of these myths came from a single source, a book published in 1724. It's titled A General History of Pirates. To learn more about it, I spoke with Eric J. Dolan. He is author of Black Flags, Blue Waters.
One of the myths about Blackbeard that started with that book, General History of Pirates, there's an engraving in that book that shows Blackbeard, and he has his hair coming out from under his hat. And at the end of his hair, on both sides of his head, there are matches that are lit on fire. And if you read the text, it tells you that Blackbeard, who is already a fearsome apparition coming at you, not an apparition, a real pirate, but it tells you that Blackbeard used to go into battle with those matches lit so that his face would be robed in smoke to make him more fearsome than he otherwise would have been. But just think about it for a minute, how ridiculous it would be to go into battle with flames shooting out from under your hat. And all of the people that were attacked by Blackbeard, not a single one of them told anybody at the time about this strange attacking behavior. So that's just one of the myths that comes down to us about Blackbeard. Another one is that he had 14 wives. Well, we have no evidence that he had any wife at all. So there's a lot of stuff that you have to take with more than a grain of salt. And the best way to figure out what's good information and what's not is by triangulation, basically getting as many different sources telling you the same thing. And you can pretty much figure out what is true and what is embellished.
Well, I'm kind of thinking that your task was like going to five different scout camps around campfires, listening to ghost stories and trying to get rid of the rot.
Yep, absolutely.
Well,
one of the problems of being a writer about pirates, you know, you have Pirates of the Caribbean, the movie franchise, which is fantastic. I love watching those movies, at least the first couple. I didn't really like the last few. But when you have these depictions of pirates and these tales and legends, they are so powerful that no matter how much evidence as an historian you amass to point out that these are in fact not true stories, they still persist. One of the ones you mentioned in your intro, there is not a single instance recorded of any pirate ever burying treasure. Yet that is one of the most persistent myths about pirates. Why would they bury their treasure? There's no guarantee they're going to get back to that location in the future. Somebody else might find the treasure. And pirates were famous for spending their loot almost as fast as they acquired it.
Now, let's get into the figure Blackbeard. I know that part of your book, the aim of part of your book is to put some flesh and blood on these. Well, you know, they lost their flesh and blood by hanging or execution so many times, but you're putting it back on them. What was he like? Do you know?
Well, my answer is not going to be totally satisfactory, because despite the fact that Blackbeard is clearly, along with Captain Kidd, the most famous pirate that people will have heard about, his time on history's stage is incredibly brief. He was only known to the world as a pirate for about a year and a half. And although he was able to gather together around 400 men under his command and five different ships, and he did some very exciting or dramatic things like blockading Charleston Harbor for the better part of a week, he wasn't even close to being the most successful of pirates. At the end, he didn't have a huge treasure or hoard when he was finally captured and killed. And it's just amazing how the legend of Blackbeard so far outstrips the reality of the man. Another thing that people say is that he was this fearsome, violent person. Well, we can look through the history, and a lot of the ships that were captured, when they were let go and they went into port, they would talk about their experience. And we only have one instance where Blackbeard actually physically accosted one of his victims, whipping him. So it's the reality, as I say, is much less exciting than the legend that's grown up around him. And the funny thing is, if Blackbeard could come back and see what's happened to his reputation, he would probably love it.
Well, what accounts for the overblown reputation?
A lot of it, I believe, is his name. He was called Blackbeard at the time, and the one description we have of him, which was given in a deposition by one of the people that was captured on a ship, said that he was tall, skinny, and he had a long black beard. From that, it sort of developed, and really what gave him his legs is that book again from 1724, The General History of Pirates. It has a very large section about Blackbeard, and it talks about him being this larger-than-life character who, as I said, had 14 wives and shot one of his underlings just because he wanted to, every once in a while he needed to show who was boss, and he was very vicious, and he captured all these ships. Well, he did capture quite a few ships, but a lot of what was in that book was not real, and I believe the combination of the legend that early on, plus the fantastic branding that he had with that name Blackbeard, helped cement him in the minds of people forever after.
Well, if his career was short, he was maybe a flaming comet that just went out really quickly. Is that common for pirates to just sizzle out real quick?
Yes, a lot. Unfortunately, a lot of when you read the accounts, what you see is that a lot of pirates ended up on the gallows during the in the 1710s. There were close to 400 pirates that were hanged after being captured, and they. It's a tough life to begin with. They were not welcome at any ports, at least in the 1700s. In the late 1600s, they were, but that's a different story. So they weren't welcomed at ports. They could only go down to Nassau and the Bahamas as their refuge. And they were doing something that was inherently dangerous. Every once in a while, they had to attack a ship that they wanted to take over, and people would sometimes fight back. And then there were the military ships that were looking for them, the British Navy. So it's not a job with a great amount of job security. So a lot of these pirates only lasted for a few years. And what you also find is even with pirate ships that maybe captured 10, 15, 20 other vessels during their career, they very rarely found a ship that had on board a huge amount of treasure. There were a few instances of that I talk about in the book. But for the most part, they would overhaul merchant ships, and on board might be a bunch of lumber, pipes of wine and brandy, which the pirates greatly appreciated, but not much in the way of cold, hard cash. So when you read what these pirates plundered, you're often left with the feeling of, boy, they didn't get very much for their efforts. So maybe part of it was just loving the lifestyle and being outcasts from more traditional society.
But they also had to have a market for that lumber. If they found poles or something, they had to go into port somewhere and sell it.
Yes, it was very hard to do that in the 1710s. In the late 1600s, one of the most fascinating things I found in researching this book is these Red Sea pirates. In the late 1600s, there were many, many pirate ships that left from colonial shores, went around the Cape of Good Hope into the Indian Ocean, and attacked Mughal or Muslim shipping that was transiting between India and the Red Sea ports of Jeddah and Mocha. And these pirates were the most successful of all pirates. They would overhaul ships. Sometimes a ship that had more than 1,000 pilgrims going on the annual Hajj, loaded with cash and jewels. And these pirates would get away with a huge haul where each pirate may end up getting his cut 1,500 pieces of eight, which back then was an enormous amount of money. And then they'd go back to the colonies, And they were the fathers, sons, and brothers of the colonists. So even though they did a lot of despicable things in the Indian Ocean, they were welcomed with open arms by the colonies because they were bringing back the very things that the colonists wanted most of all. Because the colonies were starved of currency, so here they were bringing back currency. They were bringing back silk. They were bringing back jewels. And they were, as I said, the most successful of all pirates. And many of them not only were successful, but they were able to retire and weave themselves back into the communities from which they came and lead the rest of their life in relative anonymity.
You have just touched upon a very important point in your book, which has to do with the colonies, the American colonists, being kind of cozy with pirates.
Absolutely. It is the single most fascinating thing that I discovered in researching this book. And bear in mind, before I worked on this book, like all of my books, I've written 14 books. I always pick a topic I don't know a lot about beforehand because I want to remain excited about it while I'm working on the book. And when I started reading about these pirates coming out of Massachusetts and New York and Rhode Island, going into the Indian Ocean, attacking these ships, coming back with riches, and then not only being welcomed into the community, but there were kickbacks going to local governors who were giving out fake privateering licenses so these pirates could go into the Indian Ocean. There were merchants who were investing in these pirate voyages just like it was, as if it was a regular legal activity, and they were getting dividends when those pirates came back loaded with treasure. So it is this fascinating economy that arises in the American colonies before 1700 that hinges on the success of out-and-out piracy. But it changes very much, and I know there's that shift in my book. After 1700, there is a major crackdown, and that's the time when pirates no longer are welcome in the colonies, but they become persona non grata, because instead of going to the Indian Ocean and attacking these quote-unquote heathens or Muslims halfway around the world, which the colonists didn't care very much about, now in the 17-teens, in the 1720s, Blackbeard and the other pirates, they're attacking British and colonial shipping along the coast of the colonies. So they're affecting the colony's bottom line. They're no longer bringing money in. They're taking money out. And as you know, as a student of history, you've got to see where the money is going and whose ox is being gored. And when the colonists were benefiting, they loved pirates. But when the colonists were losing money to pirates, they hated them and they fought back with a vengeance.
Well, you've mentioned Blackbeard and Captain Kidd and some of these notorious figures from the past. I'm wondering if you bumped across a few also-rans who are colorful figures that few of us know about.
Oh, yeah, well, a lot. A lot of people ask me who my favorite pirate is, and I have to rephrase it. None of them are my favorites. They're all a bunch of miserable people, although I'd love to have a drink with some of them and ask them some questions. But one of the most interesting pirates to me is a guy named Ned Lowe, who operated in the 1720s, and he was literally a psychopath. He seemed to enjoy torturing and killing his victims, and one of his signature moves is cutting off people's ears and lips, roasting them and forcing them to consume their own flesh. And he had this short career. He didn't get a lot in the way of money, and we don't know what happened to him in the end. Many of his men got captured, and 23 of them were hanged in Newport, Rhode Island. But he is lesser known, but fascinating in a very disturbing way, because of all the pirates I researched, he is the most vicious, and we often have this image of pirates being these ruthless thieves, when in reality, most pirates didn't have to fight to get what they wanted because they'd raise the Jolly Roger or the black flag on their main mast, and the merchant ships they were attacking knew that that meant this was a pirate ship. If you resist, we're going to fight, and many of you might die, and most merchant ships and the captains and their crew were unwilling to die at the hands of pirates and would give over whatever they had on the ship and then often be allowed to go on their way. So anyway, there are other pirates in the book that people will say, I've never heard of that pirate, and they have fascinating stories for different reasons. There's another guy named Stede Bonnet who was a wealthy sugar plantation owner in Barbados before he became a pirate. Why did he become a pirate and what happened thereafter? It's a fascinating story, and that interweaves with Blackbeard's story as well.
I'm still thinking about Ned Lowe, and I always thought the expression "that's Lowe" came from boxing below the belt, you know. But apparently, it has to do with ears and lips. You know, the gore, the horror of it. We just have a minute or two, but did you kind of get to the point where you thought, "I've had enough of this. I've saturated myself with gore here."
Yes, there does come a point, and especially when you're writing about people that are not role models or people that you respect. Yeah, you do get a little tired of it. But a lot of the stories, as I said, they don't have so much gore because many times they didn't have to fight for what they wanted to get. So there are a lot of fascinating stories about trials and captures and adventures of pirates and adventures of the people who are pursuing the pirates. And also, the book is really a history of early America. It uses piracy as a backbone to tell that story. So it's not all blood and guts and gore. There's a lot of other really fascinating history in there as well.
And last, any contrite or reformed pirates to speak of, or did they go to the gallows, staying true to the Jolly Roger?
There were a few who, when they were standing on the platform waiting to meet their maker, that they would repent and try to atone for their sins because there were preachers who were there urging them to do so. So there are many cases of that, but there are also many cases of pirates getting up there and giving their last speech and spitting out vile comments to the people who are going to watch them hang from the gallows in a few minutes.
Well, Eric Dolan, such a pleasure to learn from you. And I understand, was it your kids who put you up to this?
Yeah. I decided to pitch some book ideas to my kids who were teenagers at the time. And when I mentioned the idea of writing a book about pirates, their eyes lit up. And I knew that had to be it because they would maybe read one of my books. They hadn't read one of my books up to that point, but I knew that if I wrote a book about pirates that they would be interested. So, yeah.
Well, the book is titled Black Flags, Blue Waters, and the subtitle, The Epic History of America's Most Notorious Pirates. Eric J. Dolan, thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Eric J. Dolan, author of Black Flags, Blue Waters. I love the title. If you're old enough to remember the Kennedy assassination, you probably remember the story of the local nightclub owner who gunned down Lee Harvey Oswald 2 days after Oswald had killed Kennedy. With Oswald silenced, a torrent of conspiracy theories flowed forth, and the odd character of Jack Ruby was always in the mix. The story of Kennedy's Avenger, next on Constant Wonder.